Welcome back to part two of Broad Appeal, The Good, The Bad, and The Crazy, Whoopi Goldberg edition. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
How you doing, Brian, since part one?
Well, of course, in part one, we were slightly disappointed to return to Sister Act, and now we're turning to a movie that, I have to be honest, Sean, I had never heard of before you and one of our most dedicated fans pointed us toward it.
We are going from the good, in quotation marks, to the bad, question mark.
The film is a little-known feminist insider trading comedy called The Associate.
Well, it's not that little well-known, Brian, because at age 12, I watched this comedy about insider trading. Thank you very much.
So, at age 12, you watched a film in which Whoopi Goldberg is trying to, like, start her own financial empire by posing as a man.
Yeah, well, let me just tell you. So, on Network 2 in Ireland, on, like, a Saturday evening, there always used to be a film at around, like, 4:50 p.m. And these kind of films would get put on that slot.
What is these kind of films? Like, forgotten films that nobody really watched?
Yeah, so even from just a few years before that nobody cared to see then and nobody cared to see now.
I should say that in addition to you watching this age 12, it was called to our attention by dedicated listener Peter Cook. So we should definitely give a shout out to Peter. And he was absolutely right that there is a lot to unpack in this movie.
Yes. The reason I was so excited about this particular episode of Broad Appeal is because when it comes to Whoopi Goldberg, we really had no flipping clue what was going to be good and what was going to be bad. And they all could be crazy in their own way. And this was a film where we decided to watch it and just see what happens.
You'd seen it when you were 12. I think you probably responded most to the insider trading. You know, I mean, you really were hoping for a career in the Securities and Exchange Commission, I'm sure. And the presence of Whoopi Goldberg and Diane Wiest and Bebe Neuwirth probably had little appeal to you.
Oh, well, there's that, of course. But also, I was just a particularly woke child.
Because basically, the premise of the movie is really interesting, right? It's a woman who's trying to make it in the corporate world. She is not achieving success, and she's been surpassed by her white male colleagues. And so what does she decide to do?
Well, she decides to go it alone and set up her own firm.
Mm-hmm. But actually, she's not
entirely... End of movie.
Well, no, basically, I wrote down in my notes, she's like the 90s black version of Peggy Olson, right? Like, she's...
Can we say what her name is?
Yeah, go ahead.
Her name is Laurel Ayres.
And anybody who listened to our earlier teaser knows that Sean loves the name Laurel.
Yes, I do, don't I? Yes, Laurel. Laurel Ayres.
Laurel Ayres is just one of those names that they only have in a movie. There's also a character who appears later in the movie, played by Austin Pendleton, whose name is Aesop Franklin.
Yeah, movie names.
Can I just pause to say, this movie had Diane Wiest, Whoopi Goldberg, Bebe Neuwirth, and Austin Pendleton. It's otherwise known as a chemistry set designed to make Brian like it.
Yes.
So, we were thinking maybe we were going to like this movie. I think ultimately, we probably didn't.
Whereas we liked Sister Act with its limitations, we didn't like The Associate even with its good parts.
Well, The Associate is a fascinating social document of a really earnest film that has a message. Whoopi seems really invested in this movie, would you say?
Yeah, this is all Whoopi's star power. But this is why Whoopi is always good. She illuminates the screen when she's there. Most of the time, you'll see in part three, because she just has such a great wattage to her personality. And so seeing her in the lead of any film, I'm instantly intrigued.
Once Laurel Ayres tries to start her own firm.
Oh,
the,
yeah.
The comic premise, she has little success as a woman on her own with no connections and no network from the old boys' network.
So what she does is she creates a partner. So this is a wonderful part where she meets this old fuddy-duddy Wall Street type. You know exactly what I'm talking
Played
about.
Played by Eli Wallach.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
And he's like, "You're Laurel Ayres? I thought I was meeting one person called Laurel, the other person called Ayres. Don't you have a partner?" And so in that moment, looking over this old man's shoulder, she sees a delicious glass of Cutty Sark being poured into a glass. And she says, "Yes, I do, in fact. His name is Mr. Cutty." Now, let me tell you something, Brian. That was the first time I ever heard of Cutty Sark whiskey, okay? Cut to, years later, I'm broke and I'm working in a bar in Islington, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What is the house whiskey? It's Cutty Sark.
And, okay. did this movie come back to your mind?
Yes, Brian. Every fucking time I made a drink, I would think of the associate.
Well, can I say the reason why is because once she's named this man, so she's come up with this name of Mr. Cutty based on Cutty Sark, that name, Robert Cutty, gets mentioned, I think, no fewer than 73 million times.
I think the word Cutty is said more than and, yes, no, and but in this film.
It's honestly, there's literally scene after scene where people are like, "Have you heard about Robert Cutty? It seems like Robert Cutty is here. Where's Mr. Cutty?" It, ladies and gentlemen, the name is even said by the 45th president of the United States.
Ugh.
I know. If you doubted whether this movie was good or bad, there is a cameo appearance by none other than Donald J. Trump.
"I'm here with Donald Trump, for God's sake. How long is it going
to
be?"
"I have checks sitting on two tables. Ah, Miss Ayres, how nice to see you. I have Mr. Cuddy's usual table."
"Cuddy? Looking for you."
"Sorry, Frank, but I'm going to go crash and burn with Cuddy. Call me."
Can I say something about the premise of this movie? So, I didn't know until the very, very final credits were rolling. It's apparently based on a Spanish novel called El Socio, which is Spanish for The Associate.
Mm.
But actually, I would suggest that the roots of this entire premise go far deeper. Back to Brian's greatest 20th century playwright, Mr. Bertolt Brecht.
Go for it.
Are you familiar, Sean, with The Good Person of Szechuan?
Yes. A good person or a good woman?
It depends on the translation.
Good person of Little Szechuan, depending on other translations.
Big Trouble in Little Szechuan? Anyway, the premise of The Good Woman of Szechuan is that there is a good woman, Shen Te, who gets given all this money to see, you know, how she'll use it. And she's very generous and she has to give the money out and all this stuff. But basically, the forces of capitalism conspire that everybody kind of wants a piece of her money, and she is so virtuous and good that she has to construct a male alter ego, her cousin, who she makes up, to try and be the hard capitalist who says no to people because she says yes. And it becomes this amazing, wonderful comedy. It's like one of my favorite plays of all time.
I should see it then.
Yeah, just go see it. You know, you can just see productions of The Good Woman of Szechuan on any street corner. But anyway,
you can get one from any stranger on the street.
Exactly. Well, you know, she has that kind of split personality thing going strong. And so that's sort of what happens to Whoopi here, that like she has to construct this male alter ego of Mr. Cutty, but the male alter ego just takes on a life of its own until, sort of spoiler alert, big surprise, she has to actually dress up as Mr. Cutty.
Well, let me tell you something. Sexism is endemic to our culture. You know why? Because every person in this film is obsessed with this man, okay? Like, Laurel Ayres is standing in front of them holding, I don't know, a giant check for $1 billion, and they're still saying, "Great, is Mr. Cutty here?" And it's like, are you people, am I living in a dream? What is wrong with you people?
Yeah, so the joke of it, which I suppose has a potent political point, is that there's a man who no one has ever seen, who doesn't exist.
Who we assume is white.
Yeah, who everyone assumes is white and powerful and alpha male and the kind of, like, of the Donald Trump variety. And he is essentially, he is a non-entity. You know, Whoopi is the one who's actually coming up with the business ideas. She's writing the proposals, but they keep relating to her partner and she has to keep coming up with these excuses like, oh, he's off at an Asian business conference, or he's on the golf links, or he's on a cruise, or he doesn't like to fly, like all these reasons why he wouldn't be there. So in theory, it's really representing this kind of woke message about how women are treated, and it's particularly interesting that it's a black woman. I mean, we should say that when the film begins, she's this kind of mid-level but quite successful lower-ranking person in this firm, and she's paired with a white guy played by Tim Daly. I mean, Whoopi's the brains of the partnership. There's one point where there's a really dumb joke at the beginning where he messes up Science Digest and Reader's Digest, and you're just meant to think he's like a male bimbo. But because he's white and he's like a bro, he can take the clients out to strip clubs and have business meetings there, where Whoopi feels like totally uncomfortable, and he gets the promotion that really she should have got, and this is the straw that breaks the camel's back. So it's a great setup, it's a great premise.
Yeah, it is. Do you not find that many of these films with these kind of social and racial messages weren't really suited to the 1990s? Because I think the infrastructure of how we talk about these things and the ability to call out institutionalized racism, the vocabulary wasn't entirely there. Actually, strangely enough, I think if these films were made now, they'd be a little bit more fraught.
This movie, if it were made now, who would it have? Like, Leslie Jones? Like, or Octavia Spencer?
Octavia Spencer would be a very good choice.
Yeah. So, like, you could imagine a kind of Dear White People style, slightly more edgy version of this, or feminist, you know, version of this, that really kind of addresses head on the actual things that are dealt with. Like, you have to give this movie credit that it is fundamentally premised on an idea of institutional sexism, right? Mm-hmm. There's an interesting relationship at the heart of the film. I mean, whoever thought that there would be a sisterly solidarity bond in a film between Whoopi Goldberg and Diane Wiest?
That, I don't think you should think too hard about that. That makes sense to me.
I mean, who greenlit Whoopi and Diane? What a pairing.
What a genius did.
Is it?
Diane Wiest, she's in that kind of role she played a million times over, which is kind of like seemingly scatterbrained, politely spunky, helpful, yet kind of in the way, clutterbot.
Oh, that role.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Diane Wiest goes through different phases of her career. I feel like she's in her, like, mousy-voiced phase. So she's like, basically the assistant to the white bro character. And she kind of talks like this, with that little, you know, sort of childlike Diane Wiest voice. But once Whoopi leaves the firm, Diane's, like, sisterly solidarity brings her to leave her job as the assistant and to come to, like, help Whoopi. I think, to my mind, what's the most interesting about their relationship is that at the start, Whoopi outranks Diane Wiest. So she views Diane Wiest's role in the firm as purely clerical, to quote from Hannah and her sisters, right? Like, Whoopi doesn't want to hang out with Diane. Diane also makes an interesting remark. Do you remember? So there's a scene where the boss sends Diane out to go and buy a scarf for somebody's wife or something. And Whoopi is sent along because obviously women like to go shopping. So they're off together. And Whoopi is annoyed that she is this high-ranking person has to go shopping with the secretary. And they get into a bit of a political argument. And Diane basically implies that Whoopi got where she is through affirmative action. And this was like the interesting, like, you know,
all 1 second of it.
Yeah, friction point in the film where it's like, okay, here we have a white woman and a black woman, and they're going to get into, like, identity politics. But that is kind of smoothed over relatively quickly.
Hey, at least they identify it in the first few minutes of the film, really.
Yeah. So basically, they become a partnership.
So the first thing she does is she shows up and she, you know, she picks up the secret bat phone for secretaries. You know, the bloodline that they all share, the sisterhood of the traveling secretaries. And she gets an impossible meeting set up the very next day just by calling, I don't know, Pat or someone. and says, "Oh, could you move that meeting? Oh, could you? I owe you a favor. Oh, thanks. Okay, bye."
So Whoopi becomes indebted to her for helping her get into the boardrooms that she can't get into. But then she really proves her worth by doing like this just incredible thing that no one would have ever thought of. She's like, "Oh, you know that box of proposals that you had over in the office? I put that into a database." Whoopi just stares at the monitor. The computer monitor is like, "It's all in there?" And it's just, it's amazing that these people in this film from the early 90s have never heard of typing. Like, okay. It's just like, literally, Diane's genius move is to take things out of a physical box and put them into the computer so Whoopi can look at it.
Now, I'm all for suspension of disbelief, okay? But Whoopi creates this person, and like she sets up like an AOL, like
it's like lawyers, a proto version proto of LinkedIn Facebook, or something, yeah.
Whatever. I mean, so she does all this, but the idea of creating a database of like a digital database is just beyond all comprehension.
Yeah, well, I mean, later on, Whoopi is like when she teams up with Austin Pendleton as this, like, he's this kind of nutty professor, sort of Bill Gates type, or somebody who's invented some kind of amazing software. But as he says, he says,
"I can't run a company, I can't even run a bath," which I just thought was a great line.
Well, but so his genius software is something called like Sinotex, and when they finally show what Sinotex is, it just appears to be this hovering thing on the screen that has this like dot matrix graphic that looks like the fucking Hollywood squares. It's really hard to tell what on earth it's meant to be.
You know my cinema of repugnance module that I want to teach?
Yes.
I want to do a whole module about the internet in 90s films, or computers in general.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think Sandra Bullock in The Net would be high up there on that. And this could be in there.
I always just loved whenever you would see something moving on a computer in a movie. Wait, stop the film. That's not how things work.
I'm having flashbacks to Sigourney Weaver and Copycat. So basically, there's so many other ways in which this is such a weird vestige of the 90s. Like, Whoopi's business schemes, at one point they involve,
Ponzi
like...
Ponzi schemes.
Yeah, they involve some sort of, like, weird insider trading tip that has to do with chlorofluorocarbons, legislation for something called BAMF refrigeration. And I have to say, like, while I'm all for, you know, black women moving up in the corporate ladder, it was hard to have a lot of emotional investment in, like, her, like, super objective being a, like, ruthless capitalist. Like, this is the most Clintonite movie ever, because it's basically, like, the deregulated marketplace. Everyone should get a share of it, including Whoopi Goldberg.
Yeah, it's like racial inequality will be saved by deregulation.
Neoliberalism, the movie. You know, so it's hard to, like, invest in that. And also, like, they give Whoopi also this kind of pathos, which is surrounded by the fact that her father was, like, a hardworking businessman who she invokes a few times to Diane Weiss. There's one point where she tells a kind of, like, absolutely random story about her father lighting a candle in Cleveland or something other. And then Diane Weiss literally goes, "That's a great story."
It's like what you say when you know someone's finished talking and you haven't listened to a word they've said.
It's also what you say as a screenwriter when you've written a monologue that you don't think is very good, so you have another character say, "Oh, I really like that monologue you
just
did. Wow,
what you said is just so meaningful."
So, basically, Whoopi's one asset that she has is this 6-apartment brownstone. She is able to use it as an office, but it's also inhabited by another colorful character who appears dressed as a 2-time Academy Award-winning diva.
A very good-looking one, in fact, actually.
Yes. So she comes home and down the steps flaunts somebody who says, "Hello, gorgeous," because, of course, it's a gay female impersonator dressed as Barbra Streisand.
Yeah, now I have to say, the associate takes the progress made for drag queens in Mrs. Doubtfire and imbues every drag queen with the ability of prosthetics and technical theater makeup, you know, just like that.
Yeah, we talked about the magical Negro trope, but let's be honest, the cosmetics power of drag queens in 90s films is incredible.
Yeah, it's true, because it's not just like a little bit of, you know, contouring on the nose. It's like, oh, I'm a drag queen, therefore I have full prosthesis in my makeup.
Mounds
bag.
And mounds of realistic latex that I can layer onto people, and an ability to, you know, a sort of like Ray Harryhausen, J. Roy Helland ability to transform. So basically, you're kind of waiting and waiting and waiting for the moment when Whoopi is finally going to get to play Robert Cuddy, because you are kind of thinking, well, Robin Williams got to spend most of Mrs. Doubtfire, like, running around in prosthetic makeup.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when is Whoopi going to get to look a bit like a cross between Martin Short, George Washington, and Ted Kennedy?
Cause yeah, if they were all alcoholics.
But it is so delayed. Like, the majority of the middle of this film consists of the same scene repeated over and over and over again.
Yes.
Which is Whoopi walking into boardrooms with men in suits with proposals and them saying, where's Mr. Cuddy? Is Mr. Cuddy here? Where's Cuddy? And she's just like, he's somewhere else.
Cuddy.
Is Cuddy in? Nobody even knows who this Cuddy is.
Mr. Cuddy?
No, he's in the bathroom.
Mr. Cuddy! Sure, two or three times of that would be fine. I mean, you know, there's Donald Trump in that scene. I mean, honestly. And it just repeats again and again. And you're just like, when are we going to get to the moment where Whoopi finally has to actually disguise herself as Cuddy? And when that finally happens, it's a bit of a letdown.
Well, it's because in Mrs. Doubtfire, the prosthetics kind of worked on his face. In this, like, they're just so impossibly heavy and cumbersome. He's just Whoopi Goldberg with a lower voice.
And white latex. Like, yeah, he's a Caucasian.
He's got, like, a serious case of lion face. You know what I mean?
I need a new look. Oh, rich, powerful, and male.
White.
Hello.
My name is Robert Cuddy.
Deeper!
And, of course, there is the inevitable scene where B.B. Newworth, as the sexy personal broker to Eli Wallach, tries to seduce Whoopi when she's disguised as a man.
Well, she's gorgeous.
Since your primary knowledge of B.B. Newworth was as Lilith from Frasier, this scene where she's in her lacy underthings, you were just, I mean, it was cinematic Viagra.
I mean, my dick was so hard. It was insane.
Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. It's a damn Yankees reference. So yeah, of course, like, she tries to jump the bones of Robert Cuddy. He has a very clever way of going into the men's room and pretending to use a urinal, which is to take a bottle of water and to pour it as if he's peeing.
No, I think it was either perfume or it was like whiskey or something.
It's some sort of liquid.
Yeah, but I actually thought that was funny because we guys all know what peeing sounds like, yeah? But it was like glug, 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 glug. And I just thought that was, because the guy who was, you know, standing beside him was like listening and hearing these splish, splosh, splashes. And I thought that was a bit of a good physical comedy.
I mean, basically, then the forces conspire. Tim Daly, as her former colleague who, you know, got the promotion, he starts to smell a rat that maybe Mr. Cuddy doesn't exist. It really goes off the deep end at one point where they try to fake Mr. Cuddy's death. And this is another parallelism to The Good Woman of Szechuan. So at that point, it ends up with, like, Diane Wiest and Whoopi using an abandoned car somewhere in Dumbo that they put a skeleton inside and then, like, send rolling down a hill, like, covered in gasoline. And then it, like, explodes into a giant fireball, which, spoiler alert, also features in the other Whoopi Goldberg movie that we're going to see. She was big into explosions in movies that really didn't need explosions. But even that, nobody really believes he's dead. And finally, she has to go to the, like, all-male private members club where Mr. Cuddy is finally going to make a public appearance and be given Businessman of the Year award. So Whoopi walks up onto the stage. And I mean, yet again, this could be a great set piece for, like, skewering sexism. And it does have a few interesting and provocative elements.
It's another Cuddy love-in where everybody's busy saying his name tens of fucking thousands of times. Tim Daly knows that Laurel Ayres is Robert Cuddy. Love saying those names. he's both presenting and accepting an award to Robert Cuddy at some kind of all-boys club, in which he has crafted some nefarious business scheme in which Robert Cuddy is going to somehow make him rich. You know. He's up there on the podium with all these old guys in the audience, and he's about to accept this award, but who shows up? Only Robert Cuddy, the man himself. Can you believe it? Tim Daly is like, you're not going to get away with this, and Laurel Ayres as Robert Cuddy is like, just watch me. And so then there's this great reveal where Robert Cuddy takes off one of his white gloves to reveal a black hand underneath. The audience gasps, what is happening, they think. So Robert Cuddy pulls off his mask to reveal Laurel Ayres underneath.
You let my work speak for itself, and look what's happened. You've made me Businessman of the Year. But in the words of Groucho Marx, I don't want to be part of a club that would have me as a member. And we've got to encourage our young people, which is why I want to share this award with the young man standing to my left. For his hard work, he's been an inspiration to me. I really owe it all to him. Take a bow.
But not before Robert Cuddy, that is, plants a big, sloppy, wet kiss on Tim Daly. And what does he say, Brian?
Woof.
Woof. He predates the entire scruff phenomena before we were woofing left and right, and creates the first cinematic woof on screen.
So this is the thing, like, when you describe this hodgepodge of elements, it sounds fascinating. Here you have an old white man shocking a room of other old white capitalists. Prolonged same-sex kiss with this other guy, which is kind of like sends frissons through the audience, and then reveals black skin underneath and, you know, basically gives this whole talk about how exclusivity is built on exclusion.
Yeah.
Great and amazing in some ways, but it lands in a very flat-footed and unrealistic way, because as soon as she has humiliated everyone in this club and revealed herself to be Laurel Ayres, instead of what would really happen in real life, which is all like they would be...
Get the fuck out
of
here!
Yeah, let's sue her! Let's take all our money back! Let's kick her out of this club! And so they're like, oh, Laurel, you've really pulled one over on us. And then...
Welcome aboard, old chum.
There's just like a jump cut. Not only does she have a successful firm, she has an entire tower that's called like Laurel Ayres Tower. There's no explanation of how she's dealt with the fact that like she's been under investigation by the SEC and had her like brokerage license revoked and all this kind of thing. And instead, we cut to Diane Wiest, who is now her like, you know, highly successful partner.
It's a bit of an Aaron Brockovich moment.
Yeah. And she's like doing HR, she's doing the interviews, and in walks Tim Daly to interview for a job, and she gets the enjoyable thing of, you know, denying him the job after he was her boss at the start of the film. And then it just ends, and we never actually see Whoopi celebrating or enjoying her triumph as a successful businesswoman. So there's just a lot of ways in which this movie just doesn't quite land in the way that it could, either as a successful comedy or as a really meaningful political satire. I don't know. It has a lot of interesting potential.
Yeah. You know, it's the same way, I should have said this in part one, it's the same way in which none of the nuns wallop anybody in Sister Act. Meaning, if it was true to life, nuns would be hitting children left, right, and center. In this one, Laurel Ayres would have been turfed out of that members' club.
Well, it's just one of those rules of screenwriting. Like, I'm sure that there's lots of room for suspension of disbelief, especially in a film where, you know, we're meant to believe that latex can trick everyone, that you're...
And all drag queens are wizards.
Yeah. But there's one thing for suspension of disbelief, it's another thing to just, like, not deal with reality. And I think, like, comedy works best when people's emotional responses to things have a kind of realism to them. Like, you mentioned, I think, in our earlier episode about the ending of Tootsie, right, which is a similarly, like, off-the-wall premise, that the way that the Jessica Lange character, like, reacts to the revelation of Dustin Hoffman's identity feels believable and feels real and leaves a lot of things open, you know? And just, sadly, the associate for all this stew of interesting material just doesn't seem to exist enough in the real world. It doesn't feel like a serious comment on anything.
But that, I think that's really what it comes down to, is that Tootsie is a very silly film about, you know, an actor who wants work, okay? But it is so tightly wound and crafted meticulously and given this expert treatment by a really skilled director, Sidney Pollack, with a wonderful cast and great script and a commitment to the story.
Well, yeah, that's the thing.
Which is what The Associate does not have.
No, because ultimately...
Mrs. Doubtfire had it a bit
more.
Yeah,
Whoopi is not able to turn Robert Cuddy into anything like an alter ego. He's just like this name that keeps getting invoked. He's a cigar that she leaves around. He's an office. He's a big game hunter with, like, rhino heads around. And it's all just sort of like one joke repeated again and again.
But that is exactly what the problem is that he's not really a character.
A last kind of side note about this. Like, Donald Trump features in a lot of cameos of different movies, like Home Alone 2 and all sorts of other things. Do you know why that is the case?
Yeah, well, Matt Damon pointed it out, didn't he? I saw this on Twitter. Apparently, if you ever wanted to film in a Trump property, you would invite him to be in the film. Getting the shooting
Yeah, it was like a
free.
Requirement.
Yeah, yeah, requirements. Of course it's a requirement. He would feature in the film... You get the premises for a full day, maybe even for free, and then what would happen is you would cut a scene.
Yeah, apparently the makers of The Associate decided not to cut it. There is...
He's in the trailer as well, you know.
There is something really fascinating about him being in the smack dab in the center of this film. Although we've called this movie the bad one, I would say that it's worth a watch for anyone who's, like, an American studies major or... I don't know.
A Whoopi Goldberg completist.
Gender studies. Oh, God. A Whoopi Goldberg completist. Those people are also known as masochists.
Yeah, I mean, you haven't lived until you've seen her as Judge Cameo in the Rocky and Bullwinkle film.
I will say the one thing about this, which is a difference from the third and final Whoopi Goldberg movie we're going to talk about. Whoopi does seem to be into this movie. I think she was probably excited by the premise. She probably thought it was more interesting and edgy than the final result turns out to be. And she's 100% committed, you know?
True.
She and Diane Wiest have some good scenes together. Sadly, she has absolutely no romantic interest yet again.
True.
And there is no question in my mind that if this film were made with a white woman, if this were Sandra Bullock or Meg Ryan or somebody, they would give her a romance.
It would end with a kiss in her office overlooking the Manhattan skyline.
There would be something like that. And just Hollywood has never been able to allow Whoopi to be a romantic lead in anything. You know, not anything that was mainstream or successful.
Yeah.
So that's a disappointment.
Oh, well.
When we talk about disappointments, though, there is one film in Whoopi Goldberg's filmography that disappointed audiences, and sadly, I think disappointed her. It's a movie that this entire podcast has been desperate to watch for years, and ladies and gentlemen, it is batshit crazy.
Can we tell them what it is? I mean, they're going to hear it tomorrow.
Once you've seen this film, ladies and gentlemen, you may want to go extinct. That's all we have to say. Tune in for the crazy conclusion of our Whoopi Goldberg triptych.
You'll hope a meteorite hits you and wipes you out immediately after you finish watching this as another hint for you. Okay, thank you, everybody. We'll see you in part 3.